You're listening to WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to spend the first segment of our show talking about sod and athletic fields. And our guest authored the book, The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadow of Sport's Greatest Fields. It's about famed groundskeeper George Toma, who, among other things, worked in the on the first 57 Super Bowl fields. Author Craig Handel is with us. He's a journalist. He's written six other collaborative books. His latest books to be published in the next year include one on entrepreneurism and another on a young man born at 23 and a half weeks and how he's overcome many problems to live a productive life. But first, with him, we're talking about the sod father, and I hope you'll join in. Give us questions you have about being a groundskeeper. Maybe you've done a little of that yourself. Or let us know how you think the field affects athletes. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Greg Handel, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, I really appreciate it. Here you're a big baseball fan as well as being a big gardener.
Well, I am, and I've watched a lot of hockey in my day here at the University of Wisconsin. I'm sure I know I've watched over 100 in-person hockey matches with the UW
Larry,
Badgers.
Larry, I got to ask you, because I worked on another book with a guy by the name of Greg Poss, who played for the University of Wisconsin. He ended up then becoming a hockey coach down here with the Florida Everblades. He also worked with a guy by the name of Raj Najawan, who is big into developing your mind. I don't know if you've ever heard of these guys.
I have, right off the top of my head, I can't think of the fact that I have, but I tell you what, George Toma, who you collaborated with on this book, is a fascinating guy. How did you come to work with him?
Well, it's a great question, Larry. He did a lot of work with the Minnesota Twins, and so before spring training started, he would come down to Fort Myers, Florida, which is where I used to live. And for many years, he worked on the fields. And so after a ball game, I went down to the field and I talked to George, and he you know, talked to me like he knew me forever, gave me one of his cards, and I always kept him in mind. And there was this magazine in Florida that I wrote about, it's called Florida Country Magazine, and I thought George would be the perfect guy to write about, because not only did he work with all these Super Bowl fields, but he worked in Tallahassee, he worked in West Palm Beach, he worked in, you know, down in Sarasota and Fort Myers. And so I called him, Larry, and said, George, would you be interested in doing a book? And he said, yes. And he says, but we're going to start at the very beginning. And then while we were having this conversation for the article, he started telling me about all his challenges with the Super Bowls over the years. And so I said, okay, maybe we got something here. And I talked to a mentor and I said that. He says, well, you better do it soon, because George is 94.
What makes his motivation for the book, I think, was player safety.
Yes. And not just for pro and college athletes, but going down to the lowest levels of youth baseball, youth football. He and Harry Gill, who used to be with the Milwaukee Brewers, and a Mr. Erickson, who worked with the Twins and the Vikings, and another gentleman by the name of William Daniel, they organized the Sports Turf Managers Association, and so George's idea was the best insurance for an athlete is a safe playing field. And so that started that organization, and that's always been his philosophy.
Well, he's sure an interesting guy. Well, here he is, 94 years old. What was the writing process like with him?
It was great because, you know, you would think at that age, memory would be a challenge. But I tell you, George's memory is as sharp as ever. And I always joke with people. I said, I know George's memory is good because he keeps telling me the same stories and they never change. So he lives in Kansas City. I lived in Florida. He's a little bit hard of hearing, but you know, Larry, sports sometimes can be the great middle ground. And so we started talking about stories and issues and I rarely did I have to repeat myself because George was really honed in. And then he started telling me these various stories.
Well, there are a lot of wonderful stories in the book. How did there's so many things he did to innovate what we see on the field. Maybe you could talk about some of the things that George did to innovate on the field.
Well, one of them actually involved the Green Bay Packers. So in 1999, he and a guy by the name of Warner, they went out to prove that grass could be grown on artificial turf, because the Packers said that they would only play this exhibition game with the New Orleans Saints if it was on a grass field. So the two of them worked together, Eddie Warner and George. And they brought in all this turf, and they got it to set, and they actually used motorboats fans to dry the field, the only way to say it is cow manure. They got that on the field. They got the field set. The game was played, and Brett Favre was among the players who complimented the field. Mike Ditka said, "Let's play two," and really that basically set the groundwork, Larry, for the United States being able to have the World Cup, because they also were able to prove to FIFA officials that the World Cup could get played on all these stadiums because they had the same rules. You have to have grass fields, and so even though they had indoor facilities and artificial turf, they were able to grow grass on the turf, and that's how they were able to get the World Cup to the U.S. About 30 years ago.
That was absolutely amazing. The other one that stuck in my mind was coloring and colors on the fields, which is something he came up with, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he and it's interesting because, you know, we're talking here the 1960s, Larry, and he was a real innovator. And so he painted the end zones, and he worked with the Kansas City Chiefs, and Lamar Hunt liked it. And then all of a sudden, Pete Rozelle liked the idea. And so what happened was Pele played there on a field and said it was the second best field he played on next to Wembley Stadium. And then the commissioner came a short time after that and said, I like the way these end zones are painted and colored. And what happened was then later in November, George ended up going to Dallas because they had their first color game on television. It was a Thanksgiving game, and they wanted the field to look good. George made it look good. And basically shortly after that, the NFL came to George and says, hey, we want you to do the first Super Bowl field. And George asked if they wanted anything at midfield. And the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, said, George, it's your field. Do what you want. And so So now, yeah, now you see all these colorful end zones and you see all these colorful midfields. And that was started by George.
You know, I bet a lot of people don't know everything that goes into groundskeeping. What do groundskeepers do today?
Well, it's funny because I just had a conversation last night with a guy by the name of Mark Rasm who works with the Colorado Rockies. And he talks about how a lot of these pioneering ideas that George had and other groundskeepers like Emil Bassard had aren't practiced as much today because they're kind of spoiled into having, they have so many crew members and, you know, and then also having artificial turf makes the job a lot easier. You know, there is an art to having a level grass field, having the right dirt, having the right mix of seed. And, you know, it's a great point, Larry, because now in the old days, they used to replant the grass. Now they just replant the sod because they have enough money to do it. And George was saying is that even with these concerts that these stadiums have now, he says you don't necessarily need to replace it with sod all the time and cost all this money. You could just replace it by, if you give it a couple weeks, he had a technique where you could lay down, you know, they had it in a 50-gallon drums with seed and with Bovamere. Again, that's cow manure, and they got the seed to bloom, and they put it down on the field, and by Friday they were cutting it, by Saturday they were painting it, and Sunday they had a game. So old school stuff, Larry.
Yeah, really, really amazing the things that he came up with. Greg Handel, our guest today, he is an author and journalist, and his latest book is titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields, the book about George Thoma. Great to have him with us. And questions or comments or experiences, I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts on this. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. WPR brings you live special coverage on election night. You can join us tonight starting at 6. We'll share results and analysis from Wisconsin's biggest races and NPR updates from across the country. That's live coverage on election night here on WPR and WPR.org. And you can join us starting at 6 o'clock. Right now, we're visiting with Craig Handel, who has co-authored the book about George Thoma. It's titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. And you can join in. I hope you do. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Adam in Viroqua, we'll give you a chance to join in.
Hi, Adam. You there?
Yes, go ahead, Adam.
Just wanted to call and say love the show. Grew up knowing George. I've been in the turf industry for golf course management, Larry. Worked a lot down in Chicago and knew about George and all his stuff from the people I worked with. And just wanted to call in and say how cool it is to hear it on, you know, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh,
Larry.
Adam, thanks a lot. A comment, Craig.
Well, a couple of things. I'm wondering if Adam's talking about the Bossard family, because one of the Bossard family are very involved with the Chicago White Sox, and you talk about a family of groundskeepers. I think they go back like 125 years of groundskeeping, not on fields all over the country. And the other thing I was going to say was, you know, it's election night, and one of the things we're trying to get for George is we've got a couple of connections with the current administration. We're trying to get George the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He's been a groundskeeper for 80 years. As you mentioned, he's worked 57 Super Bowls. We talked about what he did to get the World Cup here. He also helped his profession greatly. It used to be a part-time job for people. They weren't paid well. Now they're working full-time. They're getting insurance. They're getting benefits. And so he really not just was an innovator, but he really elevated the respect of the profession. I mean, how many times do we get into situations where people are talking about the field condition, before a Super Bowl or a playoff game in baseball?
Yeah. Adam, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. I want to go back to the beginning, the beginnings with George here.
Sure.
How did he, maybe talk about his childhood first. When did he know he wanted to become a groundskeeper?
Well, it's a great point to bring up because he was a child of the Depression. And he talked about how tough his parents had it. And then they lived in Pennsylvania. And his dad died from silicosis, which is essentially coal miner's disease. So here he is, a young teenage boy, loses his father. He actually was the last one to see his father alive. You know, they did a lot of planting and gardening. He worked with a farmer who basically said, whatever you can hold in your hand or hold in your arms is what you can take back for your family, and that's what they can eat for the weekend. So it was either chickens and corn and potatoes and that. And so he grew up as one with the land, and he found out that he didn't want to work in the coal mines, and so he became a groundskeeper. And he started, in his teens, and he worked on these fields, and he was fortunate that he had some really good mentors who helped him, like Emil Bassard, and he ended up going over different parts of the country, like right around shortly after World War II, they went up to Daytona and I think it was also in Georgia, and they actually used these fields that were used by the military and soldiers in preparation for going to war, and they turned these into ball fields after the war ended. And this is where he learned a lot of the techniques from Emil that allowed him to be the great groundskeeper that he was.
And I think it was Bill Vack who first hired him, I think when he was 17, something like that, as a head's groundkeeper.
Yeah, really young. And he trusted him. He brought him up. And, Vec was with the Cleveland Indians. And here's another interesting story is that just to give you an idea about just innovation is that the Indians players felt that his groundskeeping helped win them 5 to 7 games a year. And so because when Cleveland won its last World Series, they not only gave him a playoff share, I believe, but they also gave him a car. And he used that car he took the spare tire out of the car, and he used it to drive around the fields, and they used it to level the fields, the infield. And so that, it's just, George talked about how a lot of this stuff was trial and error and just using what you had. And that's what being a pioneer is all about.
I think it's an interesting story on the baseball side of things that he wound up in Kansas City. The Yankees wanted him.
Yes.
Talk about that.
He's a small town guy, Larry. And he not only did the Yankees organization, but the Yankees players, some of whom he knew, wanted him to work there. And he would have started, I believe, in Denver for a couple of years, and then he could have worked Yankee Stadium. But as a matter of fact, his mentor said, don't go to Kansas City. It'll flood you out in the spring and burn you out in the summer. It was just really hard to grow grass there because of the conditions. But George said, if I screw up, he said, no one will know. But what he did was actually the opposite. He got these fields to flourish. And because it's almost like the equivalent, Larry, of taking over a last place team and then getting them to the championship. And that's what he did with this field. And like I said, by doing so, Pele gave him a great compliment. And then the commissioner of the NFL said, well, we want you to do our first Super Bowl.
Yeah. And I think the Kansas City was the Athletics, who were kind of almost considered to be a farm system team, even though they were professionals for the Yankees.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a famous book out there that basically talked about all these deals that were made, and Charlie Finley put an end to it. I know in most baseball history, people do not think very highly of Charlie Finley, but when the draft was instituted, his first pick was Rick Monday, who later was traded for Kenny Holzman. Finley also drafted Vita Blue, Reggie Jackson, and later Sal Bando. And this became the cornerstone of the team when it went from Kansas City to Oakland. And the Athletics, as you well know, Larry, won 3 straight World Series in the 70s.
Yeah, good. Amazing story there. George had...
Oh, and then Larry, did you see the picture of Charlie Finley sitting on the mule in a New York hotel?
Yeah, we should spend a minute on Charlie Finley, because he did a lot of very innovative things with baseball. And his mule was, they called it Charlie O, I believe.
Yeah, he would take Larry the mule into a tavern, and if the tavern owner, he said, I'd like to get me and my mule a beer, and if the tavern owner agreed to it, then his team would stay at the hotel where the bar was. But if he didn't allow it, then he would just go down the street to the next hotel. So he did these kinds of things on field. He had like almost like a zoo out in the field. There's the great story George would tell about they had monkeys, and the monkeys would steal cigarettes from the people who were taking care of them. And one time the monkey escaped, and then they figured it wound up in like St. Louis or someplace. So the monkey went for a train ride. And, you know, as you mentioned, there was the mule, and then he also had a little mascot that popped up with baseballs for the umpires. So he was one of these guys. He's sort of like my cousin Steve Schmidt, who owns the Mallards. He's a great promoter of baseball.
Oh, he is indeed. And of course, in Kansas City, he got to be really good friends with a lot of people, including, you know, the stars and so forth, including George Brett was a big fan.
Yeah, they almost went into business together. Landscaping business, and it was going to be like a cut above or something like that. But George were very good friends. And as a matter of fact, George Brett wrote the first foreword on George's first book.
Yeah, amazing story. Well, he worked with Harry Gill a long time, as you mentioned earlier, a long time Brewers groundskeeper, to start the Sports Field Managers Association. And you kind of got at that, but that really was very important for the profession.
It was. I think it really just took it from a bunch of guys who were groundskeepers to an organization that we take our jobs very highly, very, very seriously. We want to do the best for the players. And, you know, one of the story, and this is where you gain trust. So one of the people who thought very highly of George was Jim Steig, who essentially ran the Super Bowl and the NFL draft for about 25 years. And if you remember Desert Storm that year, the Super Bowl was in Tampa, and And obviously they wanted to have a military theme for their halftime show. Well, the field, they had so many pregame kind of rehearsal type events during the week and it wore down on the field. And so midfield did not look good at all. So here they are. And this goes to show you how good George and his crew was. George says on a Saturday night, he says, "I've got to replace the middle of the field." And Jim Steak says, "No way, you're crazy." So George said, "I thought I was going to get arrested because we got in a bunch of cars and vans and trucks. And we went down to the University of Tampa soccer field. We rammed the gates. We went on the outskirts of the field. We grabbed all the field. We grabbed all the sod, put it back in the car, took it back to the stadium, laid it down, tamped it down, watered it about 3-4 in the morning. And they were able to make it work for the Super Bowl between the Giants and Buffalo.
An amazing story.
I mean, replacing the field less than 24 hours before the game. I mean, there's not a lot of people who would have the cojones to do that.
No. And as we were saying, Jim Steig, I think he was like something like the 43rd person hired by the NFL.
Yeah. He and George just worked in tandem. I mean, they worked overseas. They worked on the Super Bowls, and this was, you know, and really the Jim Steig has one of the great classic funny stories in the book. So Jim talks about the time that one of the Super Bowls that they had a Caribbean theme, and they had this tarp that they stretched from one end of the field to the other. The problem is that the tarp was longer than the 120 yards of the field. So George, and you got to take into the context of these times and what you were able to do. George yells into the crowd, "Does anybody got a knife?" And all of a sudden there's like a dozen or more knives flying onto the field. And George grabs one of the knives, cuts the tarp, they lay it down, and the show goes on. I mean, you can't do that now. You can't bring in a knife into a stadium. You know, it's what makes those books great, because you know, it talks about the way it used to be in it. It seemed like it was so much fun.
It did. Just rolling out those tarps. There are quite a few stories in your book about that.
Oh yeah. Because there were groundskeepers who I talked to that said, their worst nightmare was to get caught underneath those things, because it just takes a little air to get underneath them. And next thing you know, it's almost like how planes fly, you know, and then you get the tarp going up high, and then all of a sudden you get underneath it. And when it deflates, he says, you know, it's like the lights go out and you just wonder if you'll ever go back on. So it just, you know, it's an art form to be able to do the tarp work, especially in a quick manner, because like in places like Kansas City, you can be storming within minutes, and you've got to have that field, that tarp ready for the field to protect it.
Oh, man. Craig Handel, our guest today, his book, The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Well, George went to the first 57 Super Bowls. How did he see football change over the years?
It's a great question, Larry. The biggest thing, you know, he used to have this saying. He said, "Grass is grown by the inch, but killed by the feet." And what he saw and what other groundskeepers saw, and it became not just a frustration but bone of contention, was that the Super Bowl was becoming less about the game and more about the halftime show. And so what it did is it led to some serious issues. Not a lot got reported, because George really, really You know, he felt like the NFL shield was his shield, and he wanted to protect the NFL. And when there were problems with the field, a lot of times they would send George out to talk to them. And I know that George talked to them, to a lot of media, because I have boxes and boxes of clips that he gave me that we used in the book. And but he said that the field a lot of times, you know, really suffered because of the excess amount of rehearsing done for Super Bowls. And it led to Super Bowls like we saw a couple of years ago. The Super Bowl fields were just very slippery. And part of it was because of the excess rehearsals, and part of it was because there was too much watering done. And almost to the case where the sod would get moldy. And when it gets moldy, it stinks. And the footing was just awful. And yes, more than one occasion, it caused a lot of problems.
Yeah. Well, he worked with Jim Steig for a long time. And I think when Roselle left.
Steig left.
Yeah, Steig left. Talk about that change.
That's where George said the problems began, because and George said that he and Roger Goodell had a good relationship, just as he had with Pete Rozelle and Paul Tagliabue. But George, you know, George is always very outspoken, and he told Roger Goodell, he says, Roger, I got to tell you, he says, the people who you got working for you now are not as good as what they were with Tagliabue and Rozelle. And I think Goodell resented that a little bit, because when problems came up, George brought the problems up, and Goodell would kind of give him the politically correct answer of, you know, our best men are working at it, and they're pros just like you. And it led to George being very critical of some of the people Rozelle hired. And then he wrote a letter to Roger Goodell outlining all the different problems. As a matter of fact, they when they had Super Bowl 50, when they had an issue with the field where it was so slippery, an NFL member came to George's house and he said what the problems were. And when they said they were, because at this time George was a consultant, and I think that's important for people to know, that George wasn't always running the show, although that was the perception. But when he was a consultant and these problems happened, the NFL said, got an explanation from him, and it was confirmed by others that what the field problems were. And the person who was above George says, well, we're still going to keep them. And George says, well, have Goodell and have the other people talk to him. And it was never done. And to the way where the guy needed to be told that, hey, you've got to improve the way you're doing things, or we're going to have to let you go. Problem is, they never had those discussions with them. The problems continued, and that led to the last Super Bowl George worked. Remember, that was the game with the Eagles and Chiefs. Field was just too slippery, and by the time they got to the end of the week, there was really nothing the ground crew could do, and it ended up leading to the guy who worked above him, who was Ed Mangan, who ended up losing his job.
Yeah, it was a sad situation. Craig Handel, our guest today, his book, The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. Questions or comments for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk with the president of the Milwaukee Admirals hockey team about what's to come this season, and talk about the team itself. So we're looking forward to that. And right now, happy to have with us today, Craig Handel. His book is titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or thoughts. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. An email wonders what type of person or what type of grass is best for fields, and just what is artificial turf usually made from?
Well, that's a great question. It's interesting, Larry, and you probably know this, that the Green Bay Packers field is a combination of grass and artificial turf. And the artificial turf made from synthetic fibers, and, you know, I'm drawing a blank on the type of grass. I think it's St. Augustine, but George, I'm down here in Florida, and we were having problems with our grass, and George gave me some grass tips, and it worked. You gotta have that seed to soil contact. That's the big thing, and that means raking it in, raking that those seeds into the soil, so it catches there. And and believe it or not, that's one of the problems they ran into with the Super Bowl, is that they were only putting the seed only at the top layer. It wasn't making seed to soil contact. And you probably know this as a gardener, Larry. If you don't have that contact, what you got is you got the seed hanging up on top of the grass, and it's almost like a giant hay field.
Yeah, it's a mess. And somebody, I think it was George, said you don't cut artificial turf, but you do have to clean it. There's some great stories in there.
And because they asked him what he thought was better, grass or artificial turf. He really, other than saying that you're a lot stiffer at the end of the day on artificial turf than grass, what he said was it's about the person who takes care of it. And he said, it's just like your backyard or like your porch. You've got to brush it. You've got to wash it. You've got to clean it. And obviously they used to have problems with tobacco. They used to have problems with tobacco juice, with bubble gum, and they'd use different things to take it off the artificial turf. And they said, if just like grass, if you take care of it, that's the difference between having a good field and having a bad field.
There are some great stories in there about in your book about fixing spots on fields to make them look presentable before a game.
Oh yeah. A lot of times they would get on their hands and knees, and they would go over every inch of the field, and it just that just shows the care that's taken. And I don't know if you noticed this, Larry, but one of the I in the back of the book I wrote about my experiences of talking to George. And you know, there's this famous quote from a real popular author, and he talked about how many hours it takes to become an expert. You need 10,000 hours. Well, I did some calculating with George over time, and I talked to his wife. I did put a little research into it. Over his 80-year career, we estimate that he spent about 250,000 hours. So if 10,000 hours makes you an expert, then what does 250,000 hours do?
Well, he was the kind of guy who would, you know, 70-hour weeks were often the norm.
Oh, and he'd sleep in shovels. Or I should say in wheelbarrows. He would sleep in locker rooms. He said the best night of sleep he ever got was in a wheelbarrow.
It's an amazing story. He told some stories, too, about, I want to think back to baseball for a minute, because there are things that a groundskeeper can do on a baseball field, for example, to benefit the home team or maybe go to the detriment of the team that they were about to play? Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, it was especially on grass fields, because, you know, if you had a really good bunting team, you could slightly slant the field towards in so the bunts would stay fair. But if you were facing a good team, bat bunting team, you could slant it the other way so the bunts would roll foul if they're down the line. He would, like they knew Mickey Mantle and DiMaggio in the day, they would have, their knees weren't the best, so they made the field really hard in center field. If they knew a pitcher like Catfish Hunter, they used to play games with him with the pitching toe on the rubber. They would either make it hard or soft, depending upon which he didn't like. If they had a fast team coming into town, they would water down the first few feet by first base to slow down their run game. So this is where I was talking about before, where when Bill Veeck brought him in and he worked with Emil Bassard, that in those days they felt like you could make a 5-7 game difference during a season.
It was an amazing story. It was really a lot of fun to read all the different tricks of the trade. And here's a guy in George. He was open to mentoring and lifelong learning. You know, the guy he didn't have a college education.
But he ended up teaching at colleges.
Yeah.
You know, he taught college students. He taught agronomists. He taught people who wanted to grow into groundskeeping. He, you know, among the other things too, is he worked with young black men in Kansas City. A lot of those men ascended to higher levels of groundskeeping where they ran. They were in, like, one worked for the Kansas City Chiefs for, I believe, between 20 and 25 years. He essentially helped them get promoted by him putting in a good word for them. Dave Mailer, who worked for the Milwaukee Brewers for a number of years, he worked with George a lot. George wanted to bring him to Kansas City, but for a variety of reasons that didn't happen. And then Dave went to the Boston Red Sox, and, you know, those beautiful manicured designs of the fields that at Fenway, that where the Red Sox were known for, those were Dave Mailer's creations. And he said a lot of this came from just from cutting ideas from talking to George. George used to spend time on a lawnmower trying different cuts to see what would make the grass most aesthetically pleasing. It's just a lot of trial and error stuff. Sort of like, you know, I know, Larry, you're an avid gardener. It's the same thing when you're planting. That's the same thing George used to do. You're trying, you know, what types of soils would work here? Milorganite work here, or peat moss and perlite, would that work here? Those are the types of things, you know, George tried different clays. All this trial and error stuff, which is really kind of a lost art.
Yeah. He interacted a lot with athletes, with coaches and celebrities. What are your favorite stories about his interaction with those types of people?
Yeah. One of my favorites is that there was a former coach with the Chargers by the name of Tommy Prothrow. And in those old days of the 60s and 70s, these coaches used to be smoking. And Prothrow would go through 18 to 20 cigarettes a game. And George basically, during the game, started yelling at him, said, "You're killing my field. You're letting your cigarettes out on the field." And Prothrow ended up apologizing to George, you know. And then he also mentioned the umpires. He used to have to get onto them a little bit because they would start spitting on the field. And, you know, like I said, trying to get tobacco juice out on artificial turf was not easy to do. And, you know, he would give it to the players as well as they gave it to him. And he had a really He had a really good relationship with them, Larry. As a matter of fact, when George stopped going to the Twin Spring training, he got a call, I believe it was from Rod Carew and Tony Oliva, and they said, George, get the hell down here. We need you. You know, that's and you know, that's how popular he was. And you know, he would give it as well as he could take it.
He was recognized, I believe, many times for his work, was he not?
Eight Halls of Fame. Like we said, we're trying to get him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And that's the thing, too. He did United Way commercials. He had an ESPN commercial, which is a classic. If you want, Larry, I can email that to you sometime.
Yeah.
There was a billboard made of which had him on in Kansas City. There's a bobblehead made of him. You know, just going to the different book signings with George. When we had, Larry, when we had a book signing, it was in the perfect place. It was a place called the Grass Pad. It was for people who bought seed, sod, fertilizer. We had about 120 people show up. Maybe it was even more. And they lined up outside the warehouse. And I talked to some of these people before the event started. Larry, they came from 40, 50, 60 miles away because they wanted to meet George. They wanted to get a picture with George. And he spoke to the common man, and you know, he's a legend in Kansas City, just like Bob Uecker is in Milwaukee.
Yeah. And his name was so powerful that companies donated equipment, fertilizer, and the soil itself to Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah. They did that John Deere for about a 10-year period. George was telling me donated about $800,000 of new equipment every year. So what they would do is they would give him this new equipment. He would use it through a baseball season. They then would take after the season was over, they would resell the equipment and then give him new equipment the following year. And it's a little bitter for George because he had hoped he would have gotten paid a little better for helping save the Royals all this money, but he barely got a thank you from ownership. So that's kind of the way it goes sometimes.
And even his work at the with football, with the Super Bowls, I couldn't believe how little he was paid for the consulting work that he did.
Yeah, yeah, and he wasn't the only one. I mean, a lot of these are first-rate professional groundskeepers. And yeah, and they barely were getting $20 an hour. And it's you know, it is a sore spot when you see all the millions that the NFL makes with merchandising and commercials and player salaries and all that.
Yeah, and I think we mentioned I think they now have, there are over 3,000 employees in the NFL.
Yes. Yeah, the NFL's just become a monster. I mean, that's the great thing about the Packers is that when the Packers in July give out their annual state of the union of how much they're making, it kind of is a reflection of what these NFL teams are making. And it's just, you know, the numbers are astronomical and they just keep growing.
Well, Craig, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I enjoyed the Sod Father book, your Sod Father book, very much, the story of George Toma, and I hope we have a chance down the road to talk again. Thank you so much.
Yes, and if you get down to Florida, you're more than welcome. Give me a holler.
All right. Craig Andel co-wrote the book with George Toma, The Sod Father. Great to have him with us. His subtitle, The Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. I'm Larry Mueller.
Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game.
Stopping Tom Connors there with the hockey song gets us going here on our next portion of our program, our next segment, and we're going to be talking hockey, you know, and even though they play on ice, the Milwaukee Admirals are pretty much red hot. They're coming out of a pretty strong, they had 8 straight wins to begin the season. And John Greenberg is going to tell us. John Greenberg is president of the Milwaukee Admirals. He's held that position since 2005. We want to talk about the hockey, of course, but zero in on the Admirals with John. And I hope as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Want to hear from you. Tell us about the time you went to an Admirals game. Or let us know why you think Wisconsin maybe needs an NHL team. Maybe I'll ask John about that as well. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. John Greenberg, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
There we go. Okay. Very good.
Well, great to have you with us. So the Admirals are, they've got to be in first place.
Yeah, absolutely. We started the season with, we got shut out on opening night in Grand Rapids. It was the first time in the history of the franchise to get shut out on opening night in over 50 years. And since then, we haven't lost a game. So we are on an 8-game winning streak and 8-1 in first place in the division. I believe we're in third or fourth place in our league. We've had some teams that have also gotten off to really good starts, but we're very pleased with how things have gone so far.
Explain the, maybe give us a little background on the Admirals. You said they've been going on for a long, long time. So certainly a stalwart of Milwaukee and Milwaukee sports, but give us a little history and how they are situated within the league.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we started off as a semi-pro team back when they first started in 1970. Before that, there was a little bit of a history of Milwaukee hockey. There were three or four other teams over from the 50s through the 60s that existed, but never really got any traction. But the Admirals, starting as a semi-pro team, they played that way for about 7 years prior to being purchased by Jane and Lloyd Pettit, great philanthropists here in the Milwaukee area. Lloyd Pettit, a legendary broadcaster of the Chicago Blackhawks and the Hockey Hall of Fame. But they bought the team, and Lloyd really wanted to elevate hockey in this community. And so for many years, participants in the International Hockey League, the IHL, playing in the building that we currently play in, at that time the Mecca, now UW-Milwaukee Panther Arena. And then eventually, the Pettits bought built the Bradley Center and made that wonderful gift to Milwaukee, and the Admirals moved there and were there until about 8 years ago when we kind of saw the handwriting was going to be on the wall that the Bradley Center was going away and a new building was coming, and we decided to bring it back to our roots here at Panther Arena, and we've been here ever since, and it has been the most advantageous thing for us to play in this building with the current business model that we have in terms of, it's a 9,000 seat building as opposed to an 18,000 seat building. And, last year we had our highest average attendance since we moved in here of well over 6,000 a game. So, it's just been the right fit for us to be here. But, the history of the Admirals is very rich. I've had a Calder Cup championship here in 2004. The team over the last 21 years has only missed the playoffs 3 times. The last 2 years we were in the conference finals, so one step away from the championship. So there's been a tradition of excellence, which is what we share with our players. And You know, we want to make sure that the business that we run mirrors that tradition of excellence.
I happened to be in the Chicago area last weekend. My daughter was running in cross-country championships, and I was at the ice arena there, and the Wolves, I think, and saw the banner for the Admirals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've, you know, we celebrate being in the American Hockey League together. You know, this we moved from the IHL to the American League back in 2001 when the two leagues merged, and the American Hockey League has been around for over 80 years. And there are now teams where it used to be more of a Northeast based league. Now it is literally coast to coast. We have teams in the Atlantic, we have teams in the Pacific, and teams in Canada. So it's you know, it's a very large geographic footprint. And you know, our players, this is the stepping stone to the NHL. And you know, we all work together as teams in this league, all 32 of us, to try and, you know, get our players ready to play at that next level.
Yeah, and so your it's a professional group.
No question. I mean, this is basically the way I put this. If you're a baseball fan, we are the equivalent of AAA. So if, you know, it's actually kind of amazing that the Brewers AAA affiliate is in Nashville, and Nashville is our affiliate in the NHL. So Milwaukee and Nashville have a real nice synergy together. But our players are being trained and developed here to go, you know, eventually make it to the NHL. There's actually a slogan that was created by David Poyle, who's about to go in the Hockey Hall of Fame next week, that the road to Nashville goes through Milwaukee. And our players come here to develop. And when they are basically, you know, ripe, as we like to say, they get their chance in the NHL, and hopefully they stick there and develop careers, some turning into superstars. But even in our league, over, I believe that we started this year, 83% of the players in the NHL played in the American Hockey League. So we are,
wow,
we are that step, that last step before you make it to the big show.
Yeah. Well, that's what's been behind the success, all the success in recent years, in your mind?
I think from a hockey perspective, it's frankly just our relationship with Nashville and their desire as an organization to have their players win at this level. There are some teams in our league who it's just purely about player development. They want to make sure that the guy is practicing a certain way, playing a certain way, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to surround those guys with other veteran players who can help them grow and learn how to win. And in Nashville, it's about learning how to win. So when a guy gets called up, that he gets up there and he understands that, you know, this is how we win games. This is how we sacrifice our bodies on penalty kills. This is how we, you know, treat our teammates in the room and outside of the room. And, you know, I've heard some stories of guys that have come here that have come from other places that, you know, they're so happy to be here because they want to win. They want to learn how to play in that environment and be part of that system of development. And it's been very successful. And like I said, 18 out of 21 years, you know, it's been in the playoffs. We're the only affiliate Nashville's ever had. That's a little bit abnormal. There's only two other teams in our league who've had longer relationships that way. And, you know, a lot of teams will shift affiliates. They're looking for something, what they think is going to be something better. In our case, we found the best. So we're lucky to have the relationship that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about some of the players. You got a newcomer, which happens every year, of course. Kyle Marino, he's kind of an enforcer. I already had somebody asking about being an enforcer. What's that all about?
Well, Kyle came to us after the last couple of years in Chicago, and he's one of those guys when you're playing against him, you really just, you have a very strong dislike for those guys. But then when they're on your team, you love them. So, you know, those guys, I will tell you that role has really decreased over time since I've been in the league. There used to be more fighting, and before I got there, it was really a major part of the game. Now it is far less of that. Like, you need to have some skill. You need to be able to play the game. You're not just out there to, you know, cause mayhem, so to speak. But Kyle, I will tell you that he's had a couple of skirmishes. He's out there to, you know, really keep order on the ice, and you don't want players going after your skilled guys, your highly skilled players. And whenever you see something like that, you know, Kyle and another guy on our team named Navrin Mutter and a guy named Isaac Ratcliffe, Anthony Angelo, we've got some guys who are out there that can play a physical game and you know, make sure that things stay under control. And if not, they'll do what they need to do. But Kyle, off the ice, could not be a nicer, kinder, gentler human being. And they go out there, and the lights go on, and they change into their playing persona, and it's very interesting to watch those types of players.
Well, it was kind of interesting because Kyle Marino was a big rival of Kevin Gravel.
Yeah, Kevin. Well, yeah,
you're the Admirals captain.
Yeah.
I wonder how does that work? How do the players adapt to changes like that? Or is it ever a big deal?
I think it's been pretty rare that I've ever seen a guy that was on a different team walk into our locker room and not be warmly welcomed, even if there was maybe a history in the past of some dislike. You know, I think one of the more famous stories of that, we had a player here, it was a few years ago, named Mike Liambus. And Mike was a fighter. Like, he was a tough dude. And he got into a fight with a guy on another team, and Mike got knocked out. Like, which is, you don't want that, right? So it ended, and Mike went off back to the locker room, and the intermission came, and all of a sudden the guy he was fighting with started making his way toward our locker room, and we're like, well, wait, where are you going? He's like, no, he's like my best friend. So this guy who knocked him out, you know, is like his best friend. So, you know, there's a difference between what happens on the ice and what happens the rest of the time. The fraternity of these players, it is very rare to see two guys that really legitimately do not like each other.
This year you have two newcomers in the goal, and goaltenders are so important.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we've had a lot of continuity in the goal the last few years with, you know, guys either coming back for their second year or guys coming back, you know, after being someplace else for a while, and where we knew what we had in the goal. And this year, two brand new guys. And when I say brand new to here, but not necessarily brand new to the league. You know, Matt Murray has been in our league for a while. He's had some time in the NHL with Dallas. And then young man named Magnus Krona from Sweden, who is a guy who was in San Jose last year, young player who's got a chance to be a really good player. I think he is now in the right organization to be developed. We're kind of known for developing goalies here. Pekka Rinne, Juuse Saros, both guys who played a considerable amount of time here in Milwaukee, who have gone on to Nashville and long careers. Pekka's probably going to end up in the Hockey Hall of Fame. But, you know, they're in the right place now to be taught and developed as goaltenders. And, you know, Matt's 5-0 this year, and Magnus is, I believe, 3-1. So these guys are off to a good start, and they work well together. You know, you want that bond between goaltenders is important, that they support each other and know that really in that position, I think you see teamwork on the ice, but obviously there can only be one goaltender out there at a time. So they really help each other during intermissions, during timeouts, you know, to make sure that they're in the right place. Cause you know, goalies, people often say goalies are a little bit of a weird, they're a little bit weird sometimes, but they know how to talk to each other, and they know how to, the messages that they need to share. And So far, so good. They've done a good job.
Oh, man. John Greenberg, president of the Milwaukee Admirals, our guest today. Questions or maybe an experience to share? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at the Milwaukee Admirals hockey team with our guest, John Greenberg, who is president of the Admirals. Great to have him with us. And certainly, if you have a question or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. And an email, do Nashville players underperforming or maybe coming back from an injury, do they ever come and play for the Admirals? Sort of like a Major League Baseball player who might be sent down to the minors to AAA or something.
Not sure what's going on with that, but yes, we do have players who get called up and sent down throughout the course of the season. We actually have two players right now, Mark Delgazzo and Zach LaRue, who were called up recently, and they've done a wonderful job up there of helping kind of stabilize what's been going on in Nashville, who got off to a little bit of a slow start. But we do have players who get sent down, who maybe it's a guy who's just not playing a whole lot up there, who needs to come here and get some ice time and, you know, be put into situations where they may be, you know, needed when they get called back up. So that does happen for sure. And we're here to provide that. I would say the thing that happens the least would be injury rehabs. That happens pretty rarely. Now they do most of their rehab in Nashville. And when they're ready to play, they usually put them right back in the lineup. I think it's probably been, gosh, I'd say at least 5 years since we have had a player here on an injury rehab. But a lot of times it is just more of, a guy who's been sitting out a lot and he needs to play. And so they'll send him here to kind of get him going.
Yeah. Is that a problem? Not a problem. Maybe it's an opportunity because you have guys coming in. You've got three lines, and the lines work, the guys get to learn to work together, and then you're bringing in, sort of people coming and going perhaps a little bit. It must be tougher to deal with that.
Yeah, you're 100% correct. We're lucky to have good coaches who have been here for a long time who really do know how to juggle that. Carl Taylor, Greg Rallo, and this year for their first year, Matt Donovan, they're our coaching staff. And, a lot of times the player may also be disappointed that he's been sent down. Sometimes that messaging on why he's here, it can be a really important part of whether that guy's going to fit in to the job. And so a lot of times, whatever their message is that they've been told when they are told by Nashville that they're coming here, that'll come right to Carl Taylor. And then Carl's first thing when a guy gets here is to call that guy in the office and explain to him what the expectations are and why he's here and what he needs to do to get himself back to Nashville again. So, the thing is that eventually it's hockey, and a lot of times during games, lines get jumbled up. The key is that your top two lines, generally you try not to mess around a whole lot. Lines three and four, those guys can get moved around a little bit, and you never know when somebody's going to get banged up during a game and somebody has to get moved up, or somebody goes, gets a 10-minute misconduct and isn't going to be able to play for a while, and so the lines get messed up. So that stuff happens quite a bit. And, the good thing is if they're playing in our system, right, so the teams are – everybody's in their systems.
Yeah.
If you're in the system, you know what you're supposed to be doing. Yes, learning how to play with if you're a right-handed shot and there's a guy on the other side who is also a right-handed shot, yeah, there's some refinery that needs to go on there to make sure that guys know, you know, don't pass the puck to my other side or don't put it in my skates. I'm a right-handed shot also, that kind of thing.
I play a lot of golf, and I've had I made the comment that in Canada, the country Canada has more left-handed golfers than any other country probably in the world. And I said, well, that's because they play hockey a lot there. And somebody said, well, why is that the case? Why would a right-hander want to play golf left-handed?
Yeah, that was one of the stranger things when I came to this sport also. I came from baseball, so, you know, there was never really any thought about that. You know, you're either right-handed or you're a left-handed. And if you happen to be a switch hitter, well, then so be it. But here, yeah, the amount of hockey players, especially Canadian players, I think it's kind of unique to Canada, that when they're born, they put that stick in the left hand and not in the right hand. And I wish I could tell you why that was, but it is very common. And I think, you know, if you see, you know, a lot of times you're looking for a right-handed shot to compliment the guys that are left-handed on the ice because there are so many lefties.
Who are some better veteran players that fans might recognize from seasons before that you've got on the team now?
That are on the team now, I would say, you know, you mentioned Kevin Gravel. He's our captain. He's been our captain for the last couple of years, and he just signed a two-year contract, so he's going to be here again next year. Super nice guy, really good defenseman. He got, you know, there's a reason why he's the captain. I think the, you know, our guys really respect him in the room. He's able to, you know, if there's something going on that the coaches should know about, the players that go to Kevin, and Kevin will relay that to the coaching staff. And he's just been a really good conduit for our guys. We've got some young players here who, my opinion has always been, you tell whether a guy is a prospect by watching what happens between year one and year two. So, you know, you can see a guy come here as a rookie and it's like, okay, you can see some skills and things like that, but, you know, they're still very young players. You know, they might be 19, 20, 21 years old. And now they go home for that summer and they come back in the fall for year two. They're bigger, they're stronger. They've got that year of experience, and you can see whether or not that skill level has really continued to develop. So whether or not a guy is actually going to be a prospect. And I think we've seen that this year already with a young man named Reed Schaefer. He's a big, strong forward. He's already, I think he's scored 5 goals already, which, you know, last year he wasn't scoring a ton of goals. And coming out of his junior career, he was a guy who could score. And I think he needed to learn how to play a professional game. And so now he's doing that, and you can see how that's working in a really good way for him and turning him into a prospect. You know, the name I mentioned earlier, who's now in Nashville, Zach LaRue. He was a first round draft pick for Nashville. He played here in his rookie season. You really saw him take off in the playoffs. So in the most important games, he was one of the best players on the ice. And you wanted to see how he would develop. His big thing was he also was, I believe, in the top 2 or 3 in the league in penalty minutes last year. And he needed to learn how to play within, you know, kind of the parameters of the game a little bit more. And I think we saw that at the start of the year. And I think he showed that in training camp in Nashville. And so he's up there now doing a really good job. Another young man named Fedor Svechkov was a first round draft pick also of Nashville. A young Russian kid who is a big-time center. He's going to be, I think, a guy that's going to play in the NHL for a really long time. So I think a lot of, you know, what happens here in this league is we don't have as many older players as we maybe did 10 years ago. There's been some rules put in from a league perspective that kind of prevent you from stocking up on just quote unquote old players. You can only have so many players in your lineup that have played to a certain threshold professionally. The rest of this is supposed to be development, getting these players ready to play. But you do need the older players to help guide the younger guys. So the Kevin Gravels, another player, Cal O'Reilly. Cal is Callum Easley started his career here in Milwaukee. I believe it was my first full year, so 20 years ago. He came up at the end of that season, and this past year he came back. He's played all over the world. He's played throughout our league. He's played some time in the NHL, and he's now here. And where he was a young kid when he was here before, he's now married with four kids, and he became our all-time leading scorer since moving to this league. And he's just, you know, he's a guy that guys also gravitate to just because they want to pick his brain on all the experiences that he's had and what it's going to take to get to where, you know, he's been.
You know, your head coach, Carl Taylor, he won the Louis Piri Memorial Award, I think, in the 2020 season, 2019-2020 season. What's the significance of that award?
Well, I mean, it's the best coach in our league in a given season, and that's the guy who, you know, is recognized by his peers, frankly, as the person who, you know, has gone through, maybe had to go through a ton of adversity, where maybe their team's been hurt a lot or has had a really young group and has molded them into a really good team. The year that Carl won that award, the 1920 season, that was, we had to stop short because of COVID. And we, in March, had the best team by far, and everybody thought we were going to win the championship, and we never got that opportunity to do that. But we had the best team, and he deserved to be recognized for what he built with that group. So, you know, Carl has been a really good coach in this league for a long time, and he deserves a chance, and I think he'll get one to be in the NHL. He is been a guy who's put together teams that, you know, that year we weren't in 2020, we had a 10-game winning streak. Last year, we had a 19-game winning streak. This year, we're at 8 right now and counting. You know, he really gets teams put together and believing in the right way to play. And when things go astray, he's very good about getting them put back in order. So he's a really good coach, and I look forward to seeing what happens when he gets his crack to be an NHL head coach.
Johnny, man, what are your responsibilities as president of the Admirals?
Well, I kind of oversee everything that goes on here. You know, we put all the plans in place. The beautiful thing is that we have a very collaborative group of people here. I'm very fortunate to have a very supportive owner in Harris Turr. He and I work very well together. It's kind of fun because he's often in the office right next door to me, and you know, we spend a lot of time just kind of talking about all the different things we want to do, and he's very open to all the ideas that are shared here. So it's fun because I can talk to our group and we can say, what is it that we want to be doing this year? What's something fun we should be doing? What's something, you know, how can we build on what we just did? And my job is to help get all those plans in place, get, you know, we've got people in the right chairs, and then get out of their way and let them do their thing. So I really do believe in a hands-off type of approach, but, you know, I've got my daily responsibilities. You know, I'm kind of overseeing the team finances on a daily basis. I serve as the team spokesperson for a lot of the things much like this that come up over time. You know, I represent the team at league meetings on the board of governors. So you know, it's been a really fun job.
Yeah. It sounds like plenty to do. And your own background, you had kind of a communications background, if I'm not mistaken, or your training was in that. So pretty good training for this kind of job, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. I graduated from UW-Milwaukee with a degree in mass communications. Originally, I wanted to be a radio guy, Larry. I ended up realizing that wasn't the right direction, but I was able to work for the Milwaukee Brewers in the media relations department for many years, leaving there as the director of media relations before coming here. And when Harris Turr bought the team and was looking for a president, he is also a Brewers investor, and he knew my work there, and he really wanted a PR marketing type person to come in and help, you know, raise the profile of the team, which was, I will be honest, was very close to being dead and out of business when we first came here in 2005. There were only four full-time employees left. The team, as I had mentioned earlier, with Lloyd and Jane Pettit, they had both passed away, and the team was being operated out of their family trust. And, you know, the major philanthropists in our town, and the trust still wanted to do a lot of philanthropic work, and frankly the hockey team was draining a lot of that away. So they, you know, wanted to sell the team, and Harris came in and bought it and asked me to come along, which is, you know, still amazing to me to this day. But it's been a blessing, and I think a lot of the training I had throughout my career and in my time with the Brewers and in college really helped me to get to this point.
You know, and a goal of yours, I know, is to make the Admirals an important part of the community. How are you doing that?
Oh, that's a great question. We really strive to do that on a daily basis here. Just, you know, one kind of major exclamation point that we, you know, for us is we play a game every year for charity. It's a regular season game. We lower our ticket prices to try and fill the building, and then we donate a portion of every single ticket, paid ticket from the day, out to a nonprofit, which this year will be Children's Wisconsin. That game over time has donated almost $500,000 back to local nonprofits. We also really work hard to be out there, you know, in the community wherever we can, frankly. But, you know, we certainly are big with the youth hockey community throughout southeastern Wisconsin and beyond. Our players go out to skate at local rinks with youth hockey organizations. This year, we'll be doing that in a couple of weeks. And that's something I know our players look forward to because it's taken them back to their roots.
Yeah,
being out there with little kids. We also started a program a couple of years ago where we bring in kids from the Boys and Girls Club and other, you know, local agencies that, you know, where these kids have never had a chance to either put skates on or experience what hockey's all about. And we bring them into our locker room and we get them all dressed up in hockey gear, and they get their own jersey and they sit in a locker with their nameplate on it. And they go on the ice maybe for the first time ever. And they're out there with our players and with some professional skating coaches, and it's amazing to watch these kids. You know, some kids are really excited and they're gung-ho, and some kids are a little scared about doing it. And it's funny because the ones that were the most scared to go out there are the ones, by the time they're done, are buzzing around out there. And I'm just like, it's amazing to me just watching that and seeing the joy in these kids' faces. And you hope that maybe someplace along the way, maybe one of those kids wants to become a youth hockey player, or, you know, just that light bulb goes on that, hey, this is a sport that I think I'd like to try. And that's been a real important initiative of ours the last few years. But we also give away a lot of money through our Power Play Foundation to nonprofits and support a lot of events to try and help make Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin better.
While you were talking, I flashed back to a friend of mine. His son, when he was just a young kid, wanted him to be out on the ice, and he had to use a chair to kind of push around,
yeah, sure,
to stay up, and he wound up playing an awful lot of hockey in grade school, high school, and on. But after that start, which Mike thought he might never be able to actually learn how to skate well.
You got to start somewhere, for sure. And the chair is a very common tool.
Oh, we lost you a little bit there on your volume. We lost you a little bit there. John Greenberg, our guest today, president of the Milwaukee Admirals. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk with John Greenberg, president of the Milwaukee Admirals. Questions for him, I hope you'll give a call. Maybe you've got an experience to share. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. the sport of hockey itself, how has it changed over the years?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Hello.
Oh, there you go.
There I am. Yeah. Well, but I apologize for this. It's not great. So how's the game changed? I will tell you, it's much faster than it was probably 15 years ago. The game has changed in terms of, as we talked about a little bit earlier, the fighting is certainly less prevalent than it was back in the day. We have a lot of rules in place to try and prevent some of the staged fighting that used to occur. We used to see like a face-off and all of a sudden all 10 guys are out there fighting with each other. That doesn't exist anymore. If that were to happen, all 10 of those guys would be thrown out of the game. So it's those types of things don't exist anymore. So it's certainly less, you know, less fighting. But yeah, the speed, like if you come to a game and you watch the different levels of hockey, let's say you went to a high school game and then you went to watch the Badgers play, and then you came to watch the Admirals play, and then you went to watch the Chicago Blackhawks play. The speed is the thing that will differentiate the teams at all of those levels. I mean, the skill, a lot of players have skill, but a lot of that speed is a gift, and the ability to skate the way they skate is a thing that is just so really amazing to watch. We often get people say, why don't you ever play the Badgers like at an exhibition game or something like that? It's like, it wouldn't be fair to watch it wouldn't be fair to the Badgers. And I'm not sure our players would get anything out of that. You know, the Badgers may have a couple of draft picks from the NHL on their roster, but those players are still a long way away from playing in our league and being, you know, a good enough player to then be considered to play in the NHL. Mm-hmm. Our guys, you know, while the NHL is the elite of the elite, our guys are certainly really, really good players that hopefully someday get that opportunity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I've seen the high school, and I've probably seen at least 100 UW games in person. But the difference in speed when you go up another level, it absolutely is like, whoa, especially when you're watching it in person. I think about football. I can remember seeing my first pro football game, where I was like in about the fifth row on the 50-yard line, and I was just dumbstruck by the speed that you don't notice in when you're watching it on television.
Yeah, no question. And I would say that, you know, one of the jobs I used to have when I was working for the Brewers before I moved into PR, I was a bat boy for the Brewers, and when the Packers used to play their games at County Stadium, we used to help out on the sidelines, and you'd be standing there 3 or 4 yards out of bounds, and all of a sudden you see these guys just flying around out here, and they're all of a sudden they're coming right at you, and you don't have any chance to get out of the way, you know. And I think, you know, just to watch this, you know, a professional athlete playing at the highest level, to be able to watch that skill and that power and that speed of any game, you know, hockey, basketball, baseball, it is just these guys are truly elite athletes at all these different levels in these sports. So, you know, it takes a lot to get there. These guys have worked all their lives to get to these opportunities, and to watch them succeed, to see our guys when they finally get called up and really establish themselves as NHL players, and eventually like a Roman Josi or a Pekka Rinne or a Philip Forsberg, who all played here in Milwaukee, who are the elite, you know, they're the elite of the elite. And then when you say who are the top 50 players in the NHL, those guys are all going to be on the list. And they all spent time here honing their skills. So whenever you come to an Admirals game, I always encourage people when they come to an Admirals game, we pass out the rosters for the game for free. We want you to know who's playing in the game. But I always say you should take that and you should keep that somewhere, not only for the guys that are on our team, but for the guys that are on the other team too. Like there, you know, there's been plenty of superstar players who we've played against in this, you know, in this league, playing for all these other teams. And so, you know, it's not just the Admirals players. Of course, we want to win and we want you to cheer for our guys, but just to really appreciate the players that are out there and say, oh, I saw that guy play in Milwaukee when he was playing for Rockford or Chicago or Iowa or, you know, wherever it may be. It's really cool to come to a game and see these future stars.
You know, one of the things that I like about what you do, too, and this is probably true for other teams, but you make you bring a lot of extras to a game. There's a lot of events and different things going on to kind of just make the game more fun, or make the make the experience more fun, like pizza night, for example, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's critical, frankly, Larry. I mean, that's critical.
Oh, shoot, we're losing you again. Doggone it. We were talking to Ian.
Get you back.
Yeah, I think we got you back.
Okay, great. So that entertainment experience is really the key to everything we're doing. You know, 36 games, so it's 36 nights, 36 different shows. Every night we want it to be a different entertainment experience, because if you're a season ticket holder here and you buy, you know, the full season, I don't want you to see the same show twice. There are nights where we're going to play well. There's going to be nights where we don't play well. You know, the nights that we play well and we have the entertainment experience, everything else, that is, those are the, you know, like gold star entertainment experiences. When we don't play well, which is going to happen from time to time over the course of a long season, all the entertainment and everything else that goes on around it, I want you, when you're leaving the building, to feel like, okay, that was a good investment. I had a good time at that. They didn't win, but that, I had fun seeing, you know, everything from the minute the door opens to the door closes, you know, the intermissions, the timeouts, all the different things that we do, all the promotions, the giveaways. I mean, it is critically important to us that we are able to provide that type of entertainment experience. And our league gives out an award for the best fan experience, and we won that twice. We think we should win it every year. But you know, we set a standard here. You know, there's a sign in our locker room for the players that says, "We win here." And that same thing goes in our office as well. It's the same mantra. Like, every day we want to find a way to win in some way. And that entertainment experience, and, you know, when a fan comes up to you after a game is over and excitedly tells you how much fun they had, that's the thing that makes me the happiest. I mean, I'll be happy that we win a championship, because in my long 40-year career, I've never won one. But, you know, to see fans having a good time and just coming up and saying what a fun time they had, you know, and coming back again and again, that's what makes me happy.
Well, and you've seen, as I think we mentioned kind of early on, but you saw an increase in ticket sales and attendance in the last few years, a very nice increase in sales. And that's how does that affect the organization and the entire district around the arena? I'm sure it's a positive.
Yeah. It's more people coming downtown. I mean, it's you know, our sponsors who are right around the building here, you know, are thrilled with the amount of people who are coming into their establishments. You know, I think it's better for the Wisconsin Center District, obviously. You know, there are more ticket facility fees, more concession money being spent, more people parking in the facilities around here. All those sorts of things, you know, add up over time. You know, you often see economic impact studies with sports teams and or with downtown business. And, you know, we think we make a positive impression on what goes on in downtown Milwaukee. So, you know, we're grateful for, you know, everybody who comes out to our games. And it does positively impact our organization. There's no question about that. Our bottom line is positively impacted by our success. You know, and the building of this business with the entertainment and everything that goes with that. You know, we've been very lucky the last 2 years to be in the conference finals, and that helps too. You know, getting the media attention for playing that long, playing into June, really gives you a jump start when you restart in October. So it's, you know, those things are such a positive, and getting off to a good start this year, I think, is going to lend to having another good year.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you were selected as one of Wisconsin's Titan 100, and that's given to executives who demonstrate exceptional leadership, vision, passion, and influence. What does that award mean to you?
Well, I've never been one for accolades. I appreciate those things. To be recognized by that, to have been nominated by somebody who thought I was doing a good job to do something like that, certainly means a lot. I mean, I appreciated the attention it gave to our organization, frankly. I thought that was, frankly, the most important thing. I've been blessed to win our league's Executive of the Year Award twice, which was voted on by my peers. That meant an enormous amount to me. Anytime I can be recognized by the people I really respect the most, those times, that is incredibly generous and something that I really appreciate a lot. And frankly, it's something that, I've got a daughter who's a senior in college who's about to embark on a professional career, and to, have her follow some of the things that I've done in my career, I think would be something that, to be recognized for those things that I can pass on to her, then I've done my job.
Well, you've done a wonderful work there in Milwaukee. And so what's the best way, we've a lot of people listening today, and some may say, I've never been to an Admirals game. How do they get to an Admirals game?
Well, the good news is we still have, we've only played two home games, so we still got 34 left. You go to MilwaukeeAdmirals.com and you can find the schedule there for the rest of the season. And a lot of weekends, we play a few weekday games. We've got some great games during the Christmas holiday window. Those are always really fun. You can find all the promotions that are on there on the website as well. More to be added there over the coming weeks. We really work hard to try and find something that's going to be a fun thing for people when they come to the games. If people have never been to a concert night, we do post-game concerts with major recording artists, which we've been doing. That predates me, but with country music, classic rock, pop music, Christian music, we've got all that. And the nice thing with those is you're buying a ticket to a hockey game and you're getting all that for free. So, it's just, there's a lot going on, Larry, and I would suggest, people should just go to MilwaukeeAdmirals.com and check it out. Look, and there's a ticket link right on there where they can buy tickets as well.
John, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much. I hope we have a chance to talk again, and I really appreciate the work you've done for the Admirals. John Greenberg, president of the Milwaukee Admirals, and hopefully we can get him back and talk again about the Admirals and their season, maybe at the end when they're playing for the championship. He's giving me a thumbs up right on that one. Thanks to you for listening in, and thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, our technical director, Jeff Robbins. I'm Larry Mailer, our executive director, Jill Nadeau.
Is the best game you can name, and the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name, and the best game you can name.